The Maxine Goodman Levin College of Urban Affairs brings together individuals who are changing the face of urban America. Today we meet Dr. Ronnie Dunn, Interim Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer at Cleveland State University and Associate Professor of Urban Studies at the Levin College. Welcome. Welcome to this episode of the Levin Podcast. I'm Kristen Blazek, Coordinator of Student Recruitment for the College of Urban Affairs, and I am joined today by Dr. Ronnie Dunn. Do you want to introduce yourself real quick, your titles?
Yes. Well, thank you for having me. I am, as you stated, Dr. Ronnie Dunn. I am the Chief Diversity Officer and also an Associate Professor of Urban Studies here at Cleveland State University.
Awesome. And we are also joined by Molly.
I'm Molly Schnook. I am the Project Manager in the Center for Community Planning and Development at the College of Urban Affairs.
All right. So now that we know who you are, where are you from?
I am from Cleveland. I'm a Cleveland native, born and for the most part raised, but I grew up on the east side of the city in the Mount Pleasant neighborhood. I graduated from Cleveland Public Schools. I did attend school in North Carolina as well, a year in junior high and a year and a half of high school, but I did graduate from Cleveland Public Schools, graduating from John Adams High School in 1979.
Oh, awesome.
And awesome. I'm the youngest of three siblings. Yeah.
So brothers, sisters?
One of each.
One of each. All right. And how's it being the youngest?
Well, you know, people always assume that you're spoiled because you're the youngest, but I want to refute that notion. I always felt that my parents somehow had more expectations of me than they did my elder siblings.
Okay.
You're the last shot.
That's it. I'm often wondering, what's going on with this? But that's a good one.
All right. So then, from John Adams, where did you go?
I actually came to Cleveland State. I first stepped foot on this campus as an 18-year-old freshman in the winter quarter of 1980. Mm-hmm. And I stayed here all of 1.5 quarters. And one day I stood in front of what is now the Vet Center and Subway, but was then the bookstore. And I looked east on Euclid and started walking to my car and said, I'm never coming back. So I didn't withdraw or anything. I just walked off and, in essence, dropped out of Cleveland State. Now, I did not discontinue my pursuit of a college education at that point. I actually enrolled in a proprietary business school that following fall. On the east side, they had two campuses, Sawyer Business College, and I earned an associate's degree in business from that. But at the time, the early 80s, the economy was very poor, a weak economy. We were under Reaganomics, as they referred to it. And I looked on the job market for 6 months, looking for something in business, in the business field. My area of concentration was in marketing and public relations. Not finding anything, I went into the Air Force and spent 6 years there as a public affairs specialist. In essence, a journalist. I was the editor of the base newspaper, first in Oklahoma, and spent my last 3 years in Panama, which was very interesting.
So. But from Panama, did you come right back to Cleveland, or was
yes, I did.
Other?
When I separated, I came back to Cleveland with only the intention of getting a divorce and relocating to Washington, D.C. I had gotten married during that time period, and
but you stayed.
I stayed, yeah. I stayed in an effort to, you know, work on the marriage, and that didn't work out, obviously. But in the meantime, I started back to school. Mm-hmm. I was disabled. I'm a disabled veteran. I tore my knee up playing basketball in service. A month before separating, I tore my ACL and meniscus, and actually didn't have the surgery until I returned to Cleveland. I had the surgery over at the VA. But that then qualified me for disability benefits, which ultimately I would use to return to school. So initially I worked various odd jobs. My first job was actually as a busboy at Thistledown Racetrack. And then from there I sold furniture. I was a furniture salesman at Tedrich Furniture Store. And ultimately a blast furnace operator at a lead smelting plant in the flats. And I had to have my blood lead levels tested monthly, and that's when I determined, this isn't the ticket. So let me return to school. So I used my VA benefits and actually started back at Tri-C. I started from scratch. I didn't count any of my prior college credits, that associate's degree from Sawyer. The only thing that gave me were two stripes when I went into the military, and then some general bookkeeping and accounting skills that later would come into play when I started my own consulting business. It was beneficial in that sense. But other than that, I often say I really didn't get much out of that associates. It was a proprietary school, and I, being first generation college student in my family, wasn't knowledgeable about the perils of a proprietary schools and all of that versus accredited institutions. Mm-hmm. So,
all right.
Yes.
So you went to Tri-C. Mm-hmm. I'm getting to your PhD. Okay. So you went to Tri-C, yes. And then where did you go?
I came back to Cleveland State.
Back to Cleveland
once
State.
Again, you learn, and that's one of the life lessons I've gotten out of this experience. Never say never, because where 13 years prior I had stood in front of the bookstore, said I'm never coming back. Well, when I got to Tri-C, my very first semester, I was registered for an African American history class, and when I walked in, the first day of class, there stood a blonde-haired, blue-eyed professor, a female professor. So I automatically assumed I was in the wrong class, given the subject matter. And I looked at the syllabus as I turned to walk towards the door. And she asked if I was looking for African American history. I said, "Oh," or she said, "Well, you're in the right place." And I looked incredulous, and I kind of started giving her a hard time myself. And another African-American female student that was there, she chimed in and saying, we started with this rhetoric. That's why we have to take our history this late in life to learn our true history and da-da-da-da-da-da. And she said, I get it. I tell you what, if you think, why don't you sit down, give me a week to show you that I do know this subject matter and I'm qualified. And if at the end of that week you feel I'm not, then I will sign your transfer so you can withdraw from the class. So I sit down begrudgingly next to this female, and we're still kind of mumbling between ourselves. And needless to say, that female student was Nina Turner. And we became fast friends from that point forward. And Nina and I, as I'm sure both of you know, she went on to become a state senator and now is a surrogate for Bernie Sanders. And she's the executive director of his political action committee. Mm-hmm. But Nina and I, our academic paths paralleled each other. And my intention upon returning to school at Tri-C were to go ahead and get a BA in business and probably sit for a CPA exam and go to work. Mm-hmm. Well, somewhere along the way, I saw that I had an affinity for the social sciences. So I was actually drawn and torn between psychology and sociology. But I knew I wanted to give back and make an impact at a broad level. So sociology most readily lent itself to that, where psychology is more on generally an individual mm-hmm. one-on-one basis. So thus I got my Associates of Arts focusing on sociology. And then Dr. Salem, that first instructor of that African-American history class, she became a mentor for both Nina and myself, and both of us were opposed to coming to CSU. And there was a small group of us, I think there were 12 students, that we were all graduating about the same time, and I actually had a scholarship offered to Middle Tennessee State, in which I had gone and visited to finish my undergrad. But she implored us to come over and take a look at First College, which was a small liberal arts college housed within the College of Arts and Sciences. So it was an independent liberal arts college. She asked us to come over, take a look at it, and she actually got a van and drove the two blocks between the Metro campus and CSU. And I was really blown away by what First College offered. The classes were seminar format classes, small classroom size. They were 6-credit-hour courses versus the norm, which were 4-credit-hours mm-hmm. at that time. So thus, you could finish your studies mm-hmm. more quickly. And they emphasized critical thinking, writing, and analysis. So I saw it as the best preparation for graduate school, which I had also become aware of the STARS program while at Tri-C. I happened to be walking down the hall and saw a pamphlet on a brochure case that asked, have you ever considered a PhD or something mm-hmm. like that? And I picked it up and looked at it, and I read it, and it was it was a pamphlet on the STARS program, which was run by the Ohio Board of Regents. And STARS stood for Students Training and Achieving Through Research and Scholarship. So I inquired about the program, and they were just starting a chapter at Tri-C, but they had one here at CSU. So that was another attraction to mm-hmm. coming back to CSU. So went ahead and transferred over to Tri-C, came in as a junior, and the STARS program, it assigned you a faculty mentor within your discipline. Well, being that I was a sociology major, my mentor in the program was Dr. Sandra Ezekiel. And she happened to have been collaborating on a research study, a funded research study with the Urban Child Research Center in the College of Urban Affairs. So aside from having taken Intro to Urban Studies under Dr. Dennis Keating in First College, mm-hmm. that was my first introduction to urban studies. And then being assigned my work assignment while Dr. Ezekiel's office was, she was in the social department housed here in Rhodes Tower, my actual work assignment was down in the Urban Child Research Center. So there I met Dr. Warney Reed, who was the director of the not Diversity Institute, the Urban Child Research Center, and Dr. D. Acosta. So I worked on that first project, and at the conclusion of that, Dr. Reed happened to have been looking for a research assistant himself, and he said he was impressed with my research skills or aptitude or what have you. So he interviewed me for the job, and I was actually hired as a research assistant as an undergrad, as a junior, and thus I've in essence worked for Dr. Reed as a research assistant, graduate assistant, research associate throughout my, all the way through my PhD program. So
what you describe is sort of a meandering path through the educational system,
yes.
right? And you didn't this idea of traditional student and you know what you're going to do
right.
and what college you're going to go to. How has that impacted the way you interact with the students that come here to Cleveland State and specifically the Levin College?
Sure. Well, one thing, college is a time period where we're really exploring and getting to know more about ourselves and our own interests. And that's what I think my experience kind of illustrates, that, you know, and I was 29 years old when I returned to school, so a non-traditional student. So, you know, coming in as an 18-year-old freshman, how many people really know what their lives calling is what I would say. And that's what I feel I found along this path. It's more than just a career or a vocation, but a calling. So I encourage students to, while you don't want to just, you know, wander aimlessly through your academic career, you know, investigate and explore different career options, things that might be of interest. And you have to have something, particularly if you're, you know, going on to graduate school, something that's going to sustain you in that interest, where it doesn't feel like work that you're getting up every day, some intrinsic value beyond a paycheck or what have you.
Well, you also have a unique perspective in having witnessed the progression of the institution of Cleveland State, right? So coming on as an 18-year-old,
sure.
and then spending, you know, your career here and in different different capacities and roles within the university. So taking to where you are today, but so, you know, describe that for us, right? The changes that have happened at Cleveland State over that time period and its place sort of in downtown Cleveland and what that looks like going forward.
Sure. Well, the obvious physical transformation of this campus has just been monumental. I mean, it's a beautiful campus, and I can't say we could always say that. You know, it was a kind of barren, drab looking place at one time, and I think that started to change under President Swartz, and it has continued through Dr. Bergman and now with President Sands. I think now we're more focused on where we were focused on the physical transformation. Now it's more the cultural, the fabric of the institution that we need to do some work on. And that's why, as you pointed out, I have spent the majority of my adult life has been affiliated with this institution in one capacity or another. All three of my degrees are from CSU, and I have grown and watched the institution grow and transform. So I know a lot of our strengths, but by the same token, I know some of the areas of growth that are needed. And that's why I'm very, I feel I'm blessed beyond belief to be in this current role that I'm serving in as the Chief Diversity Officer. You know, now I am serving on committees and in a position where we're trying to address that 18-year-old Ronnie Dunn that stepped foot on this campus, that one day decided, I'm leaving and I'm not coming back. And as I reflected back on that, and I always knew why I left and why I was opposed to coming back, it was the culture. I didn't feel it wasn't a welcoming, inclusive culture at the time on campus at CSU. And it had a reputation of actually being, race was an issue. And, mm-hmm. I recall, and I actually went back and got my transcripts from 80 because I wanted to see what was my GPA at the time. It wasn't that it wasn't like I was on the dean's list my first quarter, but I had a respectable GPA, 2.38. I mean, starting off, that's, it's...
I find that okay.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah.
First semester, you got to acclimate.
Right. So, but I recall I had an A, a C, and a D. And the A, I got that A in jazz survey class. And Howie Smith, who I still see over at the Rec Center, Howie was the professor in that class. And I could identify and relate with that because of the subject matter. Jazz, the African-American influences of jazz mm-hmm. as part of my culture. And I never forget, that was the coolest class. You would walk in, and it was in main classroom in one of the kind of auditoriums rooms that was like a pit. And he would have the lights dim and have some nice jazz music playing as you come in class. And he would be out of the class. He might come in 10 or 15 minutes after everyone's seated, and he comes in and starts playing his saxophone. It's like it was the coolest thing. But I could really relate to that class. And for me, that illustrated the importance of students being able to connect when they come on campus, having something, and in particular a faculty member that they can, communicate with and connect with. And for me, he was that. And my other class, the one I earned the D in, that was psychology. I was the only African American in the class, and I remember just feeling so out of sorts, so out of place in that class, and I didn't do well. It reflected in my grade. So, and then the second semester, I don't know, I didn't have a class that really, appealed to me, and I just didn't feel part of the broader campus community. We didn't have all of the programming and supports that we have on campus mm-hmm. now for students, so I made that decision. This wasn't the place for me, and I walked off. So now in this seat, on the other side of that, now I can try to put things in place to address that. And that is really what my focus and emphasis will be on, and trying to increase the diversity and inclusion of the campus to make it a more welcoming and inclusive campus for everyone.
So I'd like to talk about kind of diversity and inclusion from sort of two different perspectives. So the first being the 18-year-old Ronnie mm-hmm. Dunn comes mm-hmm. onto campus. But this campus is a lot more diverse
yes.
In a lot of ways now
Absolutely.
Than it was in
yes.
1982. So what does that that hook and that connection look like now for students? Not just in the classroom, mm-hmm. but in terms of student organizations and things that they
right.
can get involved in on
sure,
campus.
Sure. Well, one, just the composition of the student body itself, as you said. We actually have the most diverse student population in the state among four-year public institutions. So we have work to do on the faculty side, but the student body is very diverse and that's one of our strengths. That's an attribute that should be appealing and attractive to students. And then the vibrancy of the campus. Now the campus is part of the community, and the campus neighborhood district, I think we are now referred to as, but it's also integrated more into the surrounding community, the downtown, mm-hmm. and the broader community as well. During the time period I were here, particularly, it was much less diverse racially and ethnically, and there was a division between the African American community in particular and CSU. It was seen as an island, or, you know, and surrounded by the black community, and there wasn't very much interaction, or with the exception of the African American Cultural Center. But as an institution, it was seen as not a very inclusive or welcoming institution.
Well, and that's also, so the other side of things that I want to talk about, mm-hmm. right, which is your research and mm-hmm. the way that the college specifically, as part of this university, engages with the mm-hmm. greater Cleveland community. So in the mm-hmm. research that faculty and research centers do, the opportunities for students who become mm-hmm. somebody's GA to engage with the community and research. And so I'd like you to talk a little bit about some of the things that you've done mm-hmm. During your time at the college.
Sure. Well, I'm sure many people aren't aware or will be surprised to know that the now defunct but infamous traffic cameras that graced the city of Cleveland for mm-hmm. for 9 years and are now found in cities and municipalities throughout the state mm-hmm. actually stem from my dissertation research. Mm-hmm. I completed my PhD here in 2004, and the topic of my dissertation was racial profiling. And one of the recommendations I made after doing, you know, analyzing over 180,000 traffic tickets covering a 2-year period and analyzing it, measuring the racial demographics of our city's driving population, and determining that African Americans, while we weren't the majority of the driving population, we were the majority of those cited for traffic violations at three levels, citywide, by police precinct, of which we had 6 at the time, we currently have 5, and along 2 major traffic arteries used by racially distinct driving populations to commute to the central business district or the downtown, and those thoroughfares being Chester, which is used primarily by suburbanites and a significant majority of white drivers using that thoroughfare to commute from the eastern suburbs to the Cleveland Clinic and the downtown, and then African Americans using Kinsman Road to commute mm-hmm. from the southeast side mm-hmm. of the city to the downtown area. As many are aware, Cleveland is pretty much racially segregated, with blacks concentrated on the east side of the city and county, and whites to a lesser degree now than in the past, but primarily on the west side, and a growing Hispanic population on the lower west side. So, in essence, Cleveland was the ideal laboratory within which to conduct a study like mine. And after finding those significant racial disparities at each level, I then began trying to think of policy solutions to address it. And having been to Washington, D.C., as I stated, that was my intended place of relocating after separating from the military, and I frequented there because I have family there. So, being familiar with the use of traffic cameras in that city, the idea came to mind of recommending the use of traffic cameras to address the racial disparities found in the data in my study. And those traffic cameras are objective in and of themselves. Now, they don't care what your race, ethnicity, social class, any of that is. If you're speeding or you run that red light, if they're properly calibrated, it's gonna snap that picture. Mm-hmm. So that recommendation, I had a friend at the time who was on city council, and after I defended the dissertation and everything, and he was aware of my dissertation research, I then presented the findings to him, told him, look, you should now take this and introduce legislation to address it. Well, he was reluctant to do it. He was apprehensive, and he suggested I give it to the chair of the Public Safety Committee, which I did, who was Zach Reed at the time. And I knew Zach was politically ambitious. And with me sharing with Zach less about my study than I had just shared with yourselves, he was on the phone with Regina Brett from the Plain Dealer, a columnist, discussing what I had shared with him. And she requested a copy of the study, which I hand-carried over to the PD when they were located in their old headquarters on Superior. And she reviewed it. She called me and interviewed me after reading my dissertation. And she wrote a column. It was the week of July 4th of that year. I was actually en route to North Carolina, and I got a call from the university that TV8 wanted to interview me, and the mayor's office had contacted them and wanted to meet with me as well, and wanted a copy of my study. So I obliged all of those requests. Regina wrote two columns on the study, and the first column, I think it was published July 6th of that year. This was of 04, yeah. And she said she had gotten the most overwhelming response to any column she had written to that date. She had gotten over 300 emails and telephone calls. So she wanted to do a follow-up interview, raising some of the questions that her readers had posed. So for about 45 minutes, I fielded the questions. Mind you, if I had defended this research, I could bat those out the park.
Right. Know?
So that's what took place. And she ran the second column, and then the administration, they had a chance to review it. TV8 did their interview, and I met with the safety director, Sanford Watson, at the time. And he thanked me for the study because he had only been in his role 6 months at the time. And he said he knew that there was some issues, some problems, but this gave him something to hang his hat on. And he said, we're going to consider some of your recommendations. Well, I had actually made three recommendations. Aside from the traffic cameras, the second and third were, one, legislation to address this racial bias, to introduce and pass legislation prohibiting the use of racial profiling by the police in the city of Cleveland. Needless to say, we are still waiting on that. And secondly, the use of video cameras in all police cruisers. At that time, I think there were only six police cruisers that have video cameras in them. And the general public would assume that's standard equipment, but it's not. So that is an example of the type of research. And I always kind of reflect on how the university has now adopted the tagline of engaged learning. Well, we perfected that. That's what we do in the Urban College. That's what I always said. That's right. Our brand. We always have. So now the broader university is adopting that practice and philosophy as well.
Well, and you talk about the traffic cameras as an example and of engagement and working with the broader community on topics and issues, but that hasn't stopped, right? I mean, the traffic camera issue continues to stay outside of the other two recommendations, right? And now they've been removed, and
in Cleveland
they've been removed, and there's still questions, right?
But they're popping up in the suburbs,
the state, yes,
I just drove through Fairview, and I was like, oh look, we've got there's security cameras out here.
Well, and so that was kind of going to be the progression of that, right? We've now in that time period technologically we've gone from just traffic cameras to all the way up to surveillance. Yes. So there's a whole other host of of issues that communities will have to confront around the ability to see what people are doing.
Absolutely. Surveillance. And, you know, it really amazes me. And just to watch how that research has taken on a life of its own was amazing to me. Most PhDs and most professors will tell you, maybe outside of getting some publications out of their dissertation, many will tell you their dissertation just sat on a shelf and collected dust. But to see mine take on a life of its own, and to the point that, you know, these cameras, Cleveland was the first city in the state to adopt the use of those cameras, and then it went statewide. And the timing of it was such that it came about, the proliferation of the use of the cameras came about during the economic recession. So many cities saw the revenue stream generated by them. And that's what, I don't delude myself, that's what Cleveland saw too. Right. When they looked at other cities that were using the, it was, oh, and that's the way, unfortunately, the administration introduced it, which perverted the whole program, because you've now politicized it in a way that it negates the true potential of the use of those cameras to provide equity in the administration of and law enforcement and traffic enforcement. Right. And if you look at all of the societal issues we have, particularly among the African American community and the police, that could potentially diminish some of the conflictual interactions that we have between police and citizens of color, particularly African Americans. If you can reduce the unnecessary stops, I'd rather have get a traffic cam, and, you know, when they voted to overturn the cameras, now one of the lead proponents for that was Art McCoy, a community activist, and he's arguing for the removal of the cameras. And I went on his radio show and explained to him what the original objective and intent were of those cameras, and I disagreed with the way the city administered the cameras, because they concentrated them on the east side. The majority were on the east side, which kind of reinforced some of the disparities that already exist. But in and of itself, it still is an objective means of addressing traffic enforcement. So why not, you know, revise your administrative practices and correct those deficiencies in the way you're administering the program, rather than throw the whole thing out. And, you know, I had the perfect political soundbite for it. I'd rather be shot by a camera than a police. If I'm advocating for it, that that says it all there. And particularly at the time period when that all came to the referendum up for a vote. So anyway, did I add to
the question? Yeah, I mean, no, that is. I think that what, you know, what that illustrates for people listening is that the practical research, right, the application in the community, and also your long-term engagement around this topic, right? It wasn't just a dissertation that sat on somebody's shelf, right? It's still in use and discussion today, and it's an evolving issue, right? That you're still working with folks in the community on. It's not, I don't think that we purport to solve all the problems in the communities in which we exist, but it certainly is illustrative of the types of work that the college does. So, you know, I'd like to talk to you about, you know, what you see as, you know, next steps to that research or other that the college is doing and engaging in, and, you know, where that takes us in engaging with the community today.
Sure. Well, where that takes us, one, that research really helped to establish and solidify my academic identity in the area of race and policing, and, you know, I've become a national expert on racial profiling and, you know, constantly in the media, being contacted by the media.
And you've had the ability to bring folks nationally to Cleveland to talk at the college. Mm-hmm. We've done programs together on that topic. So to also serve as a resource, an additional resource to the community around this topic because of your stature in that area, bringing people here. You know, how can we do better?
How can we, you mean we as a community or the college?
Well, I would say we're a part of the community.
Yeah, I would say we as a community, because I want to know, we as a community, how can we do better?
As a community, well, I think I've always thought that the urban college in particular were underutilized and appreciated as a resource in the broader community for the expertise that we have and the national rank that we have. I mean, we're currently number 4, I think, or number 5. Okay, we were number 2, now we're number 5, but we're always at the top.
We added planning in
urban policy and city management in particular, that specialization. And not only myself, but other faculty members are very engaged in the community in addressing various issues affecting urban areas and urban communities, and particularly the underserved communities. Joe Mead and Rosie Tai and Megan Hatch, you know, doing the work around housing voucher discrimination.
Oh, right, source of income discrimination.
Income discrimination, and Joe with the panhandling legislation, you know. So I think we can make better use of the resources that we have here locally. All too often, you know, it's looking at myself as an example, often I find that I'm more respected for my work outside of Greater Cleveland than I am in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And as the adage goes, a prophet isn't respected at home, right? So I've kind of seen that firsthand. But, you know, that's part of it. But I'm truly heardened by this younger generation, the millennials in particular, because of their social consciousness and their openness and tolerance for difference. Not tolerance, their acceptance. They don't just tolerate. I don't particularly like that term. But they're much more open of differences and empathetic. And now that I'm not in the classroom, I don't get to share with the students as much. When we look at this current political and social environment we're in, it's troubling, it's disturbing. But I always told my students, they give me optimism for the future because they aren't as, stuck on, differences as my generation and older generations were. So.
Well, that's good to hear. I like to hear that, though. Mm-hmm. That's the one time that I will put myself back into the millennials. And say, I'm technically
there
just
can.
There. Right. And then they're like, oh, they're kind of, you know, when there's negative things, I'm like, well, really, I'm kind of on the fringe.
Right, That's kind of how I am with the baby boomer.
Right.
I'm that bridge generation.
Right. Like, okay, you got good something. I'll be a millennial. You got that something bad? Anyways.
Firmly in the middle of it.
So to wrap this up, there's one question I like to ask at the end. I know it's more of an icebreaker question. We do this every time where I'm like, I know it's more of an icebreaker question, but it's a nice thing to end with. Mm-hmm. Is what is one thing you wish more people would know about you?
One thing.
Besides all the great work that you're doing in this, you know, equity.
One thing. Well, I kind of discussed some of that with my research and the whole traffic camera thing. Most people aren't aware of that history or origins of it at all. But personally, about myself, I don't know. I have some my hobbies. I collect cars, classic cars.
The miniature ones or
no.
the big ones?
It started
the
Dean as
has
a
like
kid.
The mini ones.
Well, see that it started as a kid. We used mm-hmm. to put together the model cars, mm-hmm. and there was a hobby shop mm-hmm. in the community, and they would have contests, and we would get our cars and spray paint them and enter them in the model car contest. Well, now as an adult, a middle aged male, I said, well, I got to have some hobbies. So, you know, my dad was a mechanic, and I used to go out in the yard and, you know, hand him tools and watch him work mm-hmm. on the car. And when I first started driving, I could tune up my car and change brakes and oil and do some of the work myself. Today's car, you open the hood and it's like, okay, call the shop. But I'm in a position now to own a couple of cars. So that's what I started doing, collecting cars. I have two. I have a 1966 Bonneville, and that's a homage to my dad who passed away in 07. My father was a Pontiac man, and when I saw this car, it immediately reminded me of my dad. I said, oh, wow, Dad would love this. And the interior in that car is my earliest memory of a car. It's that interior. So every time I drive that car, I'm in the 60s. I'm mm-hmm. listening to Motown music mm-hmm. and all of that. And I have a 1982 Porsche 928.
All right.
That's the car from Scarface and Risky Business that Tom Cruise had. So,
all right.
What's
so
the one car you'd want?
That I would want.
If you could get any car, yeah.
Oh, wow. Gee. That's a
resources are not a limitation.
Resources are not a limitation.
And availability is also not an issue.
I don't know. Bugatti, maybe? I'll have to give that some thought. You know, I always have these constraints, so
right.
I haven't allowed myself to just dream.
Maybe
you
can email. Here's an email.
Right. Okay. You can help
it.
Make it happen.
Right.
Well, Bernie Marino has, a Viper? He had a car show down on the square the other year, and he handed me the keys, which look like the remote control to a video console. You know, you carry it in a briefcase.
Right.
This is $1 million car,
yeah.
$1 million-plus car. So,
like,
you know, that might, you know, I could start with something like that.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
I'd need training.
That's right. Yes. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
We'll have to have you back to talk a little bit more about some of your research, because your research is so... I want to say deep, you know, it's got a good breadth to it. So
well,
I really want to dive more into some of your current research and stuff like that and your current roles.
Sure.
So we'll definitely have to have you back.
Okay,
so
I look forward to it.
But thank you so much for having us, and thank you, Molly. If you like this video, please like, subscribe, and share. For more information about our events and programs, please visit us on our website at www.csuohio.edu/levin.